This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
To go and explain what has happened and also to offer our apologies. We've got to do it because our standing on the continent has always been high and this has lowered it quite considerably.
That's South African President Cyril Ramaphosa on the decision to send special envoys to explain the recent rash of xenophobic attacks in his country. Details coming up also. The body of former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe is at his family village in Katuma, and the U.S. has applauded Uganda's efforts to control the spread of Ebola in East and Central Africa. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, striking physicians say the apparent abduction of the president of the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association will not intimidate them into submission over their wage demands. Adigando gives us more on the story.
Three unidentified men snatched Peter Magombe late Saturday night in Harare's Budiriro Township. The Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association advised all its members and other government doctors to stay away from work in protest until he's returned. It's the latest in a string of more than 50 kidnappings since January of civil society, labor, and opposition leaders. No arrests have been made. The U.S. Embassy issued a statement today urging the government to take action for what it called human rights violations. The doctors want salary increases pegged to the U.S. dollar to cushion them from hyperinflation that is hitting the country hard and leaving residents struggling to keep up. The government initially agreed to peg doctor salaries in U.S. dollars, but it reneged amid changes in the monetary policy, which involved de-dollarizing and returning to the use of the local currency. Inflation has been reported to be between 175% and 300%. No one is sure because government has stopped releasing economic data. Economic analysts blame government's failure to implement sound macroeconomic policies. The rising prices of everything from food to electricity and gasoline has left the doctors saying they can no longer report for work due to what they call financial incapacitation. Anele Bebe, the Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association, discusses the disappearance of Peter Magombe.
He was leading an industrial section by our junior colleagues, junior medical resident officers. We have been on strike for more than 10 days now, and they were simply demanding a living wage.
Doctors say they can't cope.
The whole salary was being consumed by transport charges, fuel and fueling. And the government has been breaking its feet, as always. And instead of focusing on the issue at hand, they decided to drag the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association again in court. And after that, they gave an offer of 30% increase, which was about $1.50 in allowances. And our members took that as a slap on their face. And they said they will continue on that side until salaries are adjusted.
The doctors say the abduction is a direct violation of the fundamental right to move around freely without fearing for their lives. The government has denied involvement in the abduction. Police say they are investigating the abduction, but that there is a third force bent on tarnishing the state's image. Observers counter that there has been a pattern of intimidation, abduction, beatings, and torture of union leaders. Human rights lawyer Doug Coltart says the Magombe case is concerning because it marks a break with past abductions in which victims were released after 24 hours.
The fact that he still remains missing almost 36 hours since he was abducted is extremely concerning. The modus operandi of the abductions in the past few months has typically been that people are abducted, tortured for several hours, and then dumped somewhere in the bush and are normally found by the following morning. Really raises huge concerns as to whether he's even still alive or whether he is in an extremely bad condition in the bush somewhere. The state has every motive to do so, because they were currently in negotiations with the doctors about their wages and working conditions in the hospitals, and there have been these threats given to the leadership of the doctors, including Dr. Magombeyi, over the past few weeks.
Solwa Yangwenya, a clinical director at Mpila Hospital, attended a protest over the doctor's disappearance.
I'm very certain that a colleague has gone missing. I understand the government is already working on it to try and locate his whereabouts, but the profession is in shock.
Observers say that the abductions of union leaders may be part of a strategy to discourage protests that led to a deadly crackdown earlier this year. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
The body of former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe is at his family village in Katuma for a wake today. The wake follows a formal funeral service in Harare on Saturday. Several African heads of state attended the service to recount the legacy of a man hailed both as a liberator from colonialism and as a tyrant who helped ruin Zimbabwe's economy. Mugabe died September 6th in Singapore at age 95. The military had forced him out of power in late 2017. Saturday, a Mugabe family spokesman, Walter Chidakwa, complained about Mugabe's treatment by the government. Chidakwa says towards the end of his life, Mugabe was a sad man. Zimbabwe's citizens showed little enthusiasm for his funeral ceremony. The stadium where it was held was only half full. Teacher Betty Mokomboni was not attending the ceremony.
He's the one who ruined the economy of Zimbabwe. So I have no interest of burying such a criminal.
And after days of discussion, Mugabe's family agreed with the government's plan to inter him in a vault at the National Heroes Acre Cemetery, but it is not clear when that will happen. Tunisia's prime minister has conceded defeat in the country's presidential election as voters rejected veteran politicians and set the stage for runoff from two contrasting outsiders. With 52% of the votes counted, the election commission said Kais Saied, a constitutional law professor, was ahead with 18.7%, followed by jailed media tycoon Nabil Karoui with 15.5%. The 69-year-old Saied mounted a low-key run campaigning door-to-door as a social conservative who has talked of revamping the constitution and the voting system as part of a fight against corruption. The 56-year-old Karoui calls himself the champion of the poor and has used his Nisima TV channel to launch high-profile charity campaigns. He's detained on corruption charges, which he denies. Turnout was only 45%, down from 63% in 2014, reflecting the country's disenchantment with the political system, sending a shock into the establishment ahead of legislative elections next month. South Africa has sent out special envoys to explain the government's position on the recent wave of attacks on foreign nationals and their businesses. The country has come under criticism for failing to quickly end the attacks that left 12 people dead, hundreds displaced, and property worth millions of dollars looted or destroyed. As Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, President Cyril Ramaphosa says South Africans are not xenophobic, and he wants the rest of Africa to know it.
Ramaphosa says diplomats have been dispatched to several African countries, including Nigeria, Ghana, Senegal, Tanzania, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Zambia, with a clear mandate of repairing the country's image.
To go and explain what has happened and also to offer our apologies, and for those who have been killed, our condolences, and those who have been injured as well. We've got to do it because our standing on the continent has always been high, and this has lowered it quite considerably.
He says the team will also visit the African Union, to assure the continental body of his country's commitment to the ideals of Pan-Africanism and African unity.
We would not want to see that happening to our own nationals who are in other countries around the world, because South Africans have also spread themselves around the world.
After the attacks in South Africa, South African businesses and embassies in Nigeria and Zambia were attacked. Ramaphosa felt the hostility at the funeral of former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe in Harare, where the crowd booed him throughout his speech.
Your Excellency, heads of state and government.
Back home, there is still no agreement on how to explain the recent attacks on foreign nationals. Tebogo Mashota, a human rights lawyer, referred to the attacks as clear acts of xenophobia, which government should take full responsibility for.
What is happening currently is as a result of the incitement from our government. The utterances that they've been making, blaming all the problems of the city of Joburg, to say it's migrants basically. Because the streets are dirty, it's because of migrants. It's crime because of migrants.
But the country's Chief Justice, Mogoeng Mogoeng, insists that hunger is the cause, not xenophobia.
Why are intellectuals who are South Africans not attacking other intellectuals who come from other African countries? Why are executives in the corporate sector not attacking Africans who come from other African countries? They have what to eat. They have jobs. They have opportunities.
Last week, hundreds of foreign nationals affected by the attacks in South Africa, including Zimbabweans, Mozambicans, and Nigerians, returned to their home countries. A Zimbabwean group carried home the body of a man who was burnt to death during the attacks. Experts warn that if the South African government does not address socio-economic conditions and poor policing that allowed the attacks to happen, the violence will resurface again. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. 17 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The body of former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe is at his family's village in Katuma. Tunisia's prime minister has conceded defeat in the country's presidential election. And President Cyril Ramaphosa says South Africans are not xenophobic and he wants the rest of Africa to know it. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services Alex Azar has applauded Uganda's efforts to control the spread of Ebola in East and Central Africa. However, while the U.S. remains the primary funder of Uganda's healthcare sector, the secretary did not shy away from asking the East African country to find funds to independently sustain its healthcare budget. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Since June, Uganda has identified and isolated four Ebola victims who entered the country from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The monitoring has prevented the Ebola epidemic, which has killed nearly 2,000 people in eastern Congo, from crossing the border. U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services Alex Azar is leading a U.S. delegation to Rwanda, the DRC, and now Uganda regarding Ebola.
There is immense work that has had to be done in bolstering preparedness and response capacities, screening those crossing the border, and responding to the discovery of cases. Uganda, particularly the Ministry of Health and Minister Acheng, have risen to the occasion, providing a model for the region.
The U.S. is a major financier of Uganda's health sector, helping to combat AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, Ebola, and improve maternal and child health care. In fiscal year 2018, the U.S. provided more than $511 million in healthcare funding. Secretary Azar encouraged Uganda to be more self-sustaining.
And we have seen tremendous achievements in Uganda in terms of the building up of the public health system and healthcare infrastructure as a result of that partnership. Now, of course, over time, that needs to be more self-sustained. And that does require that Uganda invest its own resources also in the healthcare system.
Ambassador Deborah Malak expressed confidence Uganda is capable of meeting its own healthcare needs.
But one cannot expect that the U.S. government will be the donor of choice in this area, you know, an open-ended future. So it really is about building capacity and ultimately putting ourselves out of the assistance business.
On Sunday, there were reports from Tanzania that a doctor who was studying in Uganda had died of a viral infection akin to Ebola. The Tanzanian ministry quickly came out and denied the allegations, calling them rumors. Yonast again Waldemariam, the World Health Organization representative in Uganda, expressed concern about the situation.
This mysterious disease has to be investigated and samples have to be tested. We couldn't rule out any of the viral hemorrhagic fevers, and the investigation will continue. And we look forward of the Tanzanian government collaborating as per the international health regulations to address this issue.
Countries near Congo continue to be on high alert for any new cases of Ebola with strict adherence to control guidelines set by the WHO. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Uganda and Kenya have signed a pact to streamline relations between the Karamojongs in Uganda and their counterparts, the Turkana and Pokot in western Kenya. The agreement, witnessed by the presidents of both countries, seeks to foster cross-border trade, ensure peaceful and sustainable resource sharing, and introduce alternative livelihoods for the communities. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The Karamojong of Uganda and the Turkana and Pokot of Kenya are predominantly pastoral cross-border communities that share socio-cultural roots. However, they have conflicted at times over water resources, especially during the dry season. These conflicts have been blamed for underdevelopment of the communities. It is peaceful coexistence that a memorandum of understanding signed between Uganda and Kenya seeks to address. Eugene Wamara is the Kenya's cabinet secretary for devolution.
When pastoralists leave West Pokot or Turkana, they know only two things, water and pasture. They do not know the artificial borders. So today we are here to say that we want these borders to be turned into bridges instead of barriers, to integrate our communities, to develop our communities, to empower communities, and to bring transformation in this part of the country.
John Byabagambi is Uganda's Minister for Karamoja Affairs. He says the MOU also seeks to address the illegal flow of small arms and light weapons across the border.
The government of Uganda disarmed all the Karamojongs, but the Turkanas, they are still holding their guns. And some people decide, sometimes they develop the appetite of having a gun. And it was easy for them to go across and acquire it. With this memorandum of understanding, the government of Kenya will now take charge of the security of its citizens in Turkana, not the citizens taking charge of their own security.
He says the communities will also be able to share social and economic infrastructure.
If we have water this side, let us share that resource. But also we can share another resource on the other side of Turkana. They can have schools, can have markets, but all this will be jointly utilized. Whereas these people, you know, they are one person. They speak the same language, have the same culture, the origin is one, and you can't control them at the border, you can't ask for passports or what, they cross in the how they want. So if we have got joint facilities to be used together and owned by them, that will reduce the conflict between the two.
The two governments of Kenya and Uganda are responsible for mobilizing resources and ensuring political support for the MOU's implementation. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
At least six Cameroonian troops are reported dead following a wave of fighting with Boko Haram terrorists on the Central African state's northern border with Nigeria. The attacks followed a visit in which Cameroon's chief of defense declared that his military had drastically reduced Boko Haram's ability to attack. Moki Edwin Kinsaka reports from Yaoundé.
56-year-old trader Dimgui Issa says he escaped with three of his family members from the Cameroon village of Swarem that shares a boundary with Lake Chad to the Cameroon town of Kuseri after dozens of Boko Haram terrorists attacked their location, shooting indiscriminately.
Ils ont brûlé, ils ont tué. Ils ont pillé les biens de
he says the terrorists killed so many, torched dozens of houses and food items, stole goods, sheep and money. He says many people are fleeing because the terrorists have shown that they can strike at any moment and escape through the porous borders. Local media has reported that at least six soldiers were killed and nine wounded in the attacks on several Cameroon military border posts that started last Friday and ended in the early hours of Sunday. The attackers also left with huge amounts of ammunition and weapons. The military has confirmed there were attacks, but did not say how many troops were killed. It said, however, the attackers suffered heavy casualties. The attacks took place just after General René-Claude Mecca, Cameroon's chief of defense staff, visited the Central African state's northern border with Nigeria and said his troops had drastically reduced Boko Haram's ability to regroup and organize large-scale attacks on military posts, as very few have been reported within the past 2 months. Mecca says after the fresh attacks, they have taken additional security measures to protect the population. He says troops have been redeployed.
On n'a pas d'inquiétude particulière à avoir dans ce domaine.
He says the morale of Cameroon's military fighting Boko Haram terrorists has not been dampened by the attacks, and the troops are more than ever before determined not only to consolidate the achievements, but to completely crush the fighters. He says his troops have been redeployed and the situation is under control. Mecca said the attacks on military bases show that the terror group still has access to weapons illegally circulating in the region. 27 attacks targeting travelers and villagers were also reported within the past 2 weeks. The fighters seized money and food and held 6 people for ransom. Their whereabouts are not known. Dauda Sedu, conflict resolution specialist at the University of N'Djamena in Chad, says insecurity is increasing in areas where Boko Haram attacks took place because many youths who joined the terrorists but fled after promises of better living conditions were not met are unemployed. He says it is imperative for states affected by Boko Haram terrorism to create job opportunities for young people.
Thousands of people, especially young men, joined Boko Haram. It is maybe time to think about how the states are going to cope with these young people.
The Boko Haram jihadist group began its bloody insurgency in northeastern Nigeria in 2009, and it spread into neighboring Niger, Chad, and Cameroon, prompting a regional military response. More than 27,000 people have been killed and 2 million others displaced, sparking a dire humanitarian crisis in the region. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
sports fans. Brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.